Thank you very much, Joe, for that very generous introduction. Before I start, let me talk just a little bit about growing up in my father's house, because it was an amazing experience. We lived outside of Chicago, and my father, of course, was publishing some of the seminal books of the conservative movement, and he had a habit of bringing his authors home to spend the night and have dinner with us. There were four children, and we had a round table sort of like these, and the children would always be at the table. And many of these guests would come back repeatedly as the books were being edited and so on, and we got to know them quite well. The favorite was always Bill Buckley, and he was there many times. He was in his 20s then. He told good jokes. He was lighthearted, and the best thing that he did was he played jazz on the piano, and we thought that was just fantastic. Russell Kirk, not so much. Russell mumbled when he talked. He told ghost stories that we really didn't understand. He was more interested in conservatism, I guess, than entertaining the children. My mother was a Quaker, and as a result, there really wasn't very much to drink in the house. And of course, there weren't too many conservatives in those days. They all knew each other, so when one was coming to Hinsdale to have dinner, the word would go out that you'd have to wave across the street, and there was a fellow named Kenneth who had a good supply of bourbon, and he would bring it over and have a drink with whoever was there. And I do remember one time Wilmore Kendall was there for dinner, and he and my mother got in a very heated debate over whether or not you had to be baptized as a Catholic to go to heaven. Of course, I was more interested in the Chicago White Sox and my bicycle and things like that than, as were my brothers and sisters, than what was going on, but I guess some of it must have rubbed off. One quick bit of levity that I just want to tell you that really has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I thought it was a pretty good story. Angela Merkel was on her way to Paris to visit with Monsieur Hollande, and as she was going through Charles de Gaulle Airport, the immigration man stopped her, and he said, "Your name?" And she said, "Angela Merkel." And he said, "Nationality?" And she said, "German." He said, "Occupation?" She said, no, I'm just here for a couple of days." So when Joe asked me to talk about the roots of conservatism, I thought that if any audience already knows the topic, this one does. It must have been talked about, in fact, I know it was at the Philadelphia Society many times before. But nevertheless, I was honored to be asked and honored to be in front of you this evening. The American conservative movement began to materialize shortly after the end of World War II. The world at the time was dominated by liberalism, socialism, and communism. Both the Great Depression and World War II had been won by big government, and as it always does in wartime, the non-war sectors of government had expanded nearly as rapidly as the military. When the war was over, unlike the military, other parts of the government just kept on getting bigger and more powerful. Franklin Roosevelt, who had dominated American politics since 1932, had moved the country decidedly to the left. Great Britain had virtually abandoned many of its age-old principles and was on the road to socialism. The Soviet Union had been our ally in the war. Its agents had infiltrated Washington, and its fellow travelers, as they became known, were strategically placed through the government, the press, the universities, and God knows where else. If communism was viewed as somewhat odd system, the liberals found it benign enough, and the Communist Party was just another political party. So by 1945, the country was culturally conservative. The intellectual climate was overwhelmingly left. Free markets, laissez-faire economics, low taxes, limited government, private property were all on the back burner if they were on the stove at all. As George Nash, in his History of the Conservative Intellectual Movement, wrote, "The United States in 1945 was a domestic superstate, a partially controlled economy. Millions of conscripts were under arms, and much of the country feared there would be a recession or another depression once the demobilization set in. It spelled," Nash said, "for further success, of tax and tax, spend and spend, elect and elect. But things were about to change. The intellectual foundation of conservatism was laid in the decade between 1945 and 1955. A handful of intellectuals, philosophers, writers, and thinkers reacted to the steady leftward drift, the challenge to American traditions, to the vast expansion of government, and the acceptance of communism as a moral equivalent to the Western tradition. These were not just a few academics who were critical of the New Deal or interested in abstract ideas. They were men who held practical ideas that challenged the conventional wisdom. They wanted to use their ideas to change the world. And although they did not think much of his economics, they agreed with Lord John Maynard Keynes, who had said that, and I quote, "ideas are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Sooner or later, it is ideas, not vested interests, which are dangerous for good or for evil." The fledgling rightward ideas being debated and written about in those lonely times were the ideas that became the roots of the conservative cause. These were age-old ideas, formulated over centuries, which were the foundations of Western civilization and the foundations of the American Republic. There were three rather distinct schools of thought that began to coalesce soon after the war, schools of thought that would form the basis of what is now conservatism. And although they would, over time, come to know each other and even work together, they had little in common and did not think of themselves as being in the same camp, or even less, being the originators of a major philosophical and political movement. About all they had in common, in fact, was hatred of the left, from liberalism to socialism to communism. The first were the classical liberals, or libertarians, concerned about individual freedom and economic liberty, and convinced that capitalism and free enterprise was the key to economic growth and liberty. The ringleaders were all names that we know: Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, Milton Friedman, Henry Hazlitt, and a handful of others. The second were the anti-communists. Some of them were former communists themselves. They were concerned that the West was forfeiting its victory in World War II to other dictators and recognized that international communism was bent on world conquest and it was a threat to the values of the free world. They believed that the struggle between the West and communism, indeed the struggle between slavery and freedom, was a struggle to the death. The leaders were also names that are now familiar to all of us: James Burnham, Whitaker Chambers, Frank Meyer, and Fried Otley, to name a few. The third were the traditionalists. Devoted to Western civilization in all respects, they believed that faith in a transcendent being laid at the foundation of civilization. They were troubled by the decline of culture, the rise of immorality, and the spread of secularism. Their intellectual leaders were people such as Richard Weaver, Russell Kirk, and Robert Nisbet. These three groups then, independently and without realizing the implications or consequences of what they were doing, laid the stones that became the foundation of modern American conservatism. By taking ideas that had dominated Western civilization for 2,000 years and applying them to the post-war world, they gave those of us who followed the intellectual and philosophical framework on which to build a movement. What were these big ideas that were the basis of the movement? I like to break them down into four broad categories, categories which seem to me to encompass modern conservative thinking and which are the pillars on which the movement is built. The first is, of course, liberty. Conservatives believe that individuals possess the right to life, liberty, property, and freedom from the restrictions of arbitrary force. They exercise these rights through the use of their natural free will. It means freedom from oppression by government and the protection by government against oppression. It means political liberty. It means religious liberty. And it means economic liberty and the freedom to allocate the resources by the free play of supply and demand and the free market system that follows from it. It means the freedom to own property and to use it accordingly. According to conventional liberal argument, the concept of liberty arose during the 18th century Enlightenment and the struggle against an oppressive and reactionary church. Conservatives know better. The idea of liberty originated 1,000 years before Christ with the Hebrews, who recognized that a moral existence came from God and was perfected in the early Christian world as the concept of choice and free will, with the understanding that there were consequences to the choices that were made. They knew that individuals possessed both a sovereign conscience and certain inalienable God-given rights. That idea arose from the letters of Paul the Apostle in the first century, expanded upon by Augustine in the fourth, and subsequently by Christian writers of the Middle Ages who developed the idea of God-given free will and of a conscience. The second pillar is the concept of order and tradition. One of the essential foundations of the conservative philosophy is preserving the values that have been established over centuries and which have led to an orderly society. It is belief in human nature and the ability of man to build an orderly society that respects human rights and that has the capacity to repel the forces of evil. Order means a systematic and harmonious arrangement both within one's own character and in the state of the commonwealth. It signifies the performance of certain duties and the enjoyment of certain rights in a community, such as used in the phrase the civil society. Conservatives recognize that order is necessary for life and the pursuit of their dreams. It may be best understood by observing its opposite, disorder, which is well describes what conservatism is not. The third pillar is the rule of law. Conservative philosophy is based on the belief that it is crucial to have a legal system that is predictable and orderly, that allows people to know what the rules are and to be able to enforce those rules equally for all citizens. It means that the government, as well as the governed, is subject to the law, and it means all people are to be equally protected by the law. The rule of law promotes prosperity and it protects liberty. It means, as John Adams famously said, a government of laws and not men. The fourth pillar is belief in God. Conservative belief is tethered on the idea that there is an allegiance to God which transcends politics and which sets the standard on which politics is based. For conservatives, there must be an authority which is greater than man and which is greater than any ruler, king, or government, so that no state can demand our absolute obedience or attempt to control every aspect of our lives. There must be a moral order, conservatives believe, that lies beyond the political order. Belief in God as part of conservative foundational philosophy does not mean mixing up faith and politics, and it does not mean settling religious disputes politically or vice versa. It does not mean that conservatives have to be avid churchgoers or even particularly religious. In fact, Bill Buckley used to say, the conservatives did not really need to believe in God, but they had to believe that God was there. They could be agnostics or even atheists as long as, he said, they weren't God haters like Ayn Rand. Our great friend, the late Stan Evans, who Joe mentioned earlier in his book, The Theme is Freedom, and it's a book which everybody in this room should read if you haven't already, wrote that, and I quote, "The precepts of our religion provided the conceptual building blocks for the free societies of the West, including the very idea of liberty as we know it, limits on the power of the state and institutions that gave these concepts practical expression." Each of these four pillars is closely related to the other. Liberty, for example, is considered a gift of God and must be protected by the rule of law. The rule of law itself is dependent on the natural law, a transcendent law reflected in every orderly and civilized society, demarcating good and evil. Tradition and order are best reflected by our common law, a law developed over centuries by reasonable people in their everyday lives, which sets the rules for social order consistent with the past. If liberty, tradition and order, the rule of law, and belief in God are the fundamental tenets of conservatism, Where did they originate, and how did they become shaped into a coherent and credible political philosophy? Russell Kirk, in his seminal book, The Roots of American Order, introduces the idea of the four great cities that Joe also talked about earlier, where the principles that are the foundation of the American founding were born. Because these principles are so consistent with the principles that are the foundation of American conservatism, Kirk's four great cities are as applicable to our topic this evening as they are to the American founding. The first of those cities is Jerusalem, where the concept of the transcendental order was born. That true law, call it natural law if you will, comes from God, and that God is the source of order and justice. And from Jerusalem came one of the primary tenets of conservatism. There is something greater than man that we don't have and we cannot have all the answers. It was something my father used to talk to about when we were children all the time. Liberals, he said, thought that man was unflawed, which was why they were so convinced that government, a product of man, and therefore also unflawed, could solve man's problems. Conservatives know otherwise, which was one reason why they were so distrustful of big government. The second of Kirk's cities is Athens, where the idea of the social order arose, what was required for people to live together and to thrive in society. The idea, in other words, of community and how individuals need to cooperate with each other in order to reach the highest degree of ethical and political life. The philosophy of Plato and Aristotle could, no doubt, take up several entire Philadelphia Society meetings. Suffice it to say for this evening that our roots are deep in that philosophy. Then there is Rome, where we acquired the notion of the Republic, of the separation of powers, checks and balances, and the control of political power. From Rome came as well the idea of the rule of law, how law can preserve order and liberty, and how it needs to be consistent and reliable. Kirk's fourth city is London. The foundation of what is now American conservatism was laid with the Magna Carta in June 1215, just 1,000 years ago, and evolved into the idea of the common law, which applied equally to all and taught the concept of the permanence and supremacy of the law, which was to be obeyed by everybody. The influence of the British political philosophers on conservative ideals could indeed have filled many books and don't lend themselves well to serious analysis in an after-dinner speech. But let me mention just a couple. William Blackstone argued that natural law was the basis of all law, was rooted in Christian ethics, and declared that man had innate rights to personal security, to personal liberty, and to private property. Others include, of course, John Locke, who expressed the radical idea that government has a moral obligation to protect life, liberty, and property, and then when that government fails to protect the rights of the individual, the people have the right to rebel against it. Then there are the Scotsman Adam Smith and the Irishman Edmund Burke. One set the stage for libertarian and classical free market economic theory, and the other, as much as anybody else, is the intellectual godfather of traditional conservatism. Burke argued, among much else, that the wisdom of tradition and order and the wisdom of any one individual is minuscule compared with the collective wisdom accumulated by our ancestors over the centuries. Finally, the wisdom of Jerusalem, Athens, Rome, and London landed just around the corner from where we are now sitting here in Philadelphia in the last quarter of the 18th century. The American founders had studied the Bible, they'd read the classics and the British political philosophers, they knew the history of Western civilization. Weaving together the best elements of that tradition, they formed what would endure as the greatest experiment in political community founded on the concepts of liberty, morality, and justice. By doing so, the American founders were also the founders of the American conservative cause. The Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution might be described as the most successful conservative documents of all time. They provide a practical codification of the doctrines of modern American conservatism. And it is why thoughtful conservatives increasingly describe themselves as constitutional conservatives, believing as they do in the necessity to return to a system of limited government which honors the rule of law. So, how did these philosophical notions, these pillars or roots become a political movement? And when conservatism became a political movement, did it evolve into a coherent governing philosophy? Let me talk about that for a minute. The libertarians, the traditionalists, and the anti-communists gained considerable momentum throughout the decade of the 50s and into the 60s. And as the 60s wore on, these three began to realize that they did have a lot in common, and began to work with each other to try to transform their ideas into practical solutions and, in a word, to turn the trajectory of the United States from left to right. No small part of the reason these disparate intellectuals began to come together in the same camp, how these roots began to develop into a movement, was due to a small group of writers, editors, lecturers, and publishers, men who had the wisdom and foresight to recognize how these issues sprang from similar and intertwined roots, and who were able to weave their big ideas into one piece of cloth. There were initially small journals, the newsletters and pamphleteers, the Freeman, Human Events, and the early publications of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and I'm always proud to say the efforts of my father, Henry Regnery, among many others. Two best-selling books, both in the early 1950s, may have had as big an impact on the future of the conservative movement as anything else. Bill Buckley's God and Man at Yale, published in 1951, an instant bestseller, set academia on its ear and awakened the world to the dominance that the left had established in American universities. God and Man at Yale was followed by Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind, published in 1953, which became a sort of intellectual guide book to the foundations of conservatism. For the first time, with The Conservative Mind, conservatives had an historical manifesto, a book that would define who they were, what conservatism was, and what and whose thinking it was based on, and what its consequences were. With the publication of The Conservative Mind, it's safe to say that conservatism was suddenly intellectually respectable. A few years later, in 1955, Bill Buckley's founding of National Review had as much to do with what would follow as anything else. For the first time, it brought many of the writers and intellectuals who had formed the movement together on the same pages. People such as Russell Kirk, Whitaker Chambers, Frank Meyer, Wilmore Kendall, James Burnham. And it provided an intelligent, well-written, and well-produced publication discussing the issues of the day as well as the broader themes of conservative philosophy. But the catalyst, the single most important effort to turn conservatism from an intellectual exercise into a credible political philosophy was the publication in 1960 of a little 120-page book by a two-term senator from Arizona. Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative, in one single sweep, changed American conservatism from philosophy to politics, from theory to practice, from ideas to action. The book was ghostwritten by Brent Bozell, Bill Buckley's Yale debate partner, brother-in-law, and intellectual comrade in arms. Bozell was a Goldwater speechwriter and confidant, but the book was vintage Goldwater through and through. The challenge to conservatives today, Goldwater said when the book was published, is quite simply to demonstrate the bearing of a proven philosophy on the problems of our own time. According to Goldwater biography Lee Edwards, the little book took the foundational beliefs of conservatism, the things I have just been talking about, and set them out as rational and understandable political philosophy. Further, it presented a vision of the nation that the world as it should be, not a compromise with the world as it was. And perhaps most important, at least for our purposes tonight, it was, as Lee Edwards wrote, a remarkable fusion of the three main strains of conservatism of 1960, traditionalism, classical liberalism, or libertarianism, and anti-communism. And it did all of this, Edwards concludes, with remaining faithful to Goldwater's stated positions on issues ranging from foreign aid to organized labor to education, and reflected his emphasis on freedom and responsibility. The Conscience of a Conservative sold nearly 4 million copies, one of the largest selling political books of all time. Its impact is reflected as well as anywhere else by what my old boss, Senator Paul Laxalt, told me about it. I was a young lawyer in Carson City, Nevada, Laxalt said, and one of my clients sent me a copy of Conscience of a Conservative. God, I found it absolutely fabulous. There wasn't anything around like that, and I just feasted on it. It became my political Bible. A year later, Laxalt was elected Lieutenant Governor of Nevada and was the first statewide elected official to endorse Goldwater. And, of course, Goldwater was nominated in 1964, closing the gap between philosophy and politics. That led to 1980 and Ronald Reagan. And that, of course, is another story for another day. So we have established that the roots of conservatism are deeply embedded in the noblest traditions of Western civilization. Who could deny that the names of those whose ideas and principles, Plato, Aristotle, St. Paul, Augustine, Locke, Burke, Adam Smith, and the rest, are the bedrock of Western thought, are also the bedrock of American conservatism? With that in mind, I think it's useful to look at the roots of the ideology that is the antithesis of conservatism, the ideology that we spend much of our time battling and arguing with, and the ideology that represents everything that we oppose, American liberalism. As I was preparing this talk, I asked several friends what they considered to be the roots of liberalism. Most gave me a blank stare. Eric Alterman, a professor at City University of New York, an MSNBC regular, and a columnist for The Nation, writes that liberalism arose as a matter of pure pragmatism with next to no theory. That is consistent with the way liberals usually describe their origins because, first, they don't want to let Marxism creep into the conversation. And second, because it is clear their clever way of convincing the world that a problem needs to be fixed for benign reasons, when in fact their motive is usually to move things further to the left. Although Alterman's theory has been often repeated, those who have observed liberalism closely know what it can be is an aggressive doctrine unashamedly pursuing the transformation of the country without regard to the consequences. The single most penetrating root of American liberalism is no doubt progressivism, which arose in the 1880s and 90s and was developed and defined by Woodrow Wilson, probably the closest person to the father of American liberalism that there is. Wilson believed that the Constitution and the majority that it reflected were outdated. The idea of natural rights and natural law, Wilson believed, were naive and based on a flawed view of human nature, and that human nature itself was progressive and perfectible. By using the forces of government, unrestrained by the constitutional order, Wilson believed that the world could be perfected and idealized, that it would satisfy every spiritual and practical need of humanity. Although liberal programs made only moderate headway during his administration, what Wilson thought and said resonated with enough people to have had a great moral and intellectual impact. Franklin Roosevelt picked up this pitchfork where Wilson left off. For FDR, it was all about socioeconomic rights, which he described as personal rights, but which were in fact entitlements. Said FDR, "As liberals, we insist that the government has the definite duty to use all its power and resources to meet new social problems with new social controls, to ensure to the average person the right to his own economic and political life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Roosevelt's entitlements may have seemed like a good idea at the time, benign as they were, but in the true liberal fashion of ignoring the consequences of their imagined solutions, entitlements have spiraled out of control and may have imperiled liberalism to the point where those entitlements are unmanageable. 20 years after Roosevelt died, Lyndon Johnson, whose only philosophical attribute was getting more power for himself, picked up the failed liberal programs of the Kennedy years, pushed them through Congress, launched them, and liberalism was off to the races. Between his War on Poverty and Great Society, Johnson instituted literally hundreds of programs covering education, health care, environmental and consumer protection, civil rights, immigration reform, housing and urban affairs, and the arts and humanities, criminal justice, and on, at a cost to the present estimated at over $20 trillion. Liberalism was embedded into the American culture. Our current president has convinced himself, at least, that it is his job to move the country yet another notch to the left. But like so many other things I've touched on this evening, that's another topic for another time. I believe that liberalism has, sad to say, won the culture war. But is it a credible political philosophy? One can probably make the case that it was for the first half of the 20th century. It did, after all, dominate American politics until 1980, and the country, despite all its problems, did pretty well. Certainly an arguable point. But as its progeny expanded, entitlements, special interests, big and unwieldy government, and reliance on big government's beneficiaries for votes, I submit that it is no longer a credible governing philosophy. Conservatism, on the other hand, a half century younger than liberalism, has taken the opposite path, becoming more credible as it matures. In closing, let me say to you that if we are to perpetuate the conservative cause, we must maintain our principles, maintain our values, and maintain our adherence to our roots. Elections come and go. Issues and legislation come and go, and politicians come and go. But our principles and our roots must continue on and on. If our movement is to grow and to have influence, it will only do so if our principles guide us in what we do and how we do it. If those principles are maintained, future generations will prosper just as we have prospered by what earlier generations did for us. Thank you.